Hey, listeners, this is Mia Lobel, one of Panoply's managing producers. I want to ask you a small favor. Here at Panoply, we're trying to learn more about our podcast listeners. We want you to tell us about the podcasts you enjoy and how often you listen to them. So we've created a survey that takes just a couple of minutes to complete. If you fill it out, you'll help Panoply to make great podcasts about the things you love and the things you didn't even know you loved. To fill out the survey, just go to survey.panoply.fm, or you can click the link we've provided in the show notes for this episode. That's survey.panoply.fm, or click the link in the show notes. Thanks.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Blue Apron. Create delicious home-cooked meals with fresh ingredients delivered right to your door. Get your first three meals free with free shipping when you go to blueapron.com/film.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips.
Replicants are like any other machine. They're either a benefit or a hazard. But if they're a benefit, it's not my problem.
And sequels, Michael? Are they just like any other movie?
Skin jobs. The whole lot of them, Josh.
Harrison Ford in that clip from Blade Runner 2049, a sequel coming to us 35 years after the original's 1982 release. The new one is directed by Arrival's Denis Villeneuve, with Ford returning as Rick Deckard and Ryan Gosling as the next generation replicant hunter. Our review and the top five horror movies of the 21st century ahead on Film Spotting. Film Spotting is brought to you in part this week by Squarespace. Squarespace, Michael, powers the relatively new Film Spotting website. Very happy with it.
Love it.
Does a Michael Phillips have his own website?
No, he doesn't.
The Tribune is all you need, huh?
It's all anybody could ever want.
That's true.
And need.
Well, if you ever take that leap, we do highly recommend that you use Squarespace. I know a lot of our listeners have used it for their sites, whether it is film reviewing or other projects they're involved in. We recently heard from one of those listeners who did use Squarespace, Timothy Stevens.
And here's what he said. You asked for Squarespace pages, and I have one. In fact, I started it because of a code I got from your podcast, Low, so many years ago. My site features a weekly links collection of my writer and podcast appearances from other places like Marvel.com, a Tuesday list, often film-related, an ongoing, nearly completed retrospective review series on the directing works of Kathryn Bigelow, and an assortment of other pop culture-related materials. I hope you take a look and enjoy it enough to feature it on your excellent, far better than anything I do, podcast in the near future.
Thank you, Timothy. If you do want to check out his site, it is timstevensisungaje.com. I'm going to spell that for you. So Tim Please. Stevens is UNGAJJE.com. And if you like what you saw there and are impressed enough to start your own Squarespace site, you can go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, just use the offer code FILM to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So Squarespace, of course, provides beautiful templates. These are made by world-class designers. Also has a powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online in case you're moving in that direction rather than, say, a movie blog. It has the ability to customize the look and feel, the settings, and the products all with just a few clicks. There's nothing to patch or upgrade ever, but if you do run into some questions, there is a 24/7 award-winning customer support. I know Adam was very pleased with that feature when he was putting together the Film Spotting site. Ran into a couple glitches, and the Squarespace people helped him solve it right away. So you can make it yourself easily, create a website by yourself, make it stand out.
I mean, this thing does everything but the dishes.
Pretty much.
I mean, honestly.
That would be an excellent feature. Head to squarespace.com, and you can get that free trial. And then when you are ready to launch, use the offer code FILM to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Michael, thanks so much for being here. It's been a regular thing with us lately, it seems like. I hope Adam doesn't get jealous, but
yeah.
It's good to have you back.
Adam
Kempinar?
Kempinar.
Remember that guy?
Yes. Yeah. No, it's been great replacing him permanently.
Well, so I think he just came alert somewhere if he wasn't listening before with attention. It was a couple weeks back when we got to review Darren Aronofsky's Mother together. And how have the responses gone to your Chicago Tribune review for Mother? Because people seem to feel quite a bit strongly for it. You were largely positive. Did you get any of that hate mail I love to hear about
Mother? I got the sense that a lot of the suburban subscribers were actually stricken so badly by the experience of being misled into seeing the movie that they actually they're kind of in a frozen position, one hand on the laptop, or probably the old fashioned typewriter,
stunned silence,
and they haven't found. But I did get one great reply from a guy in his 80s down in Florida who picked up the review down there, and he didn't really get the movie, didn't like it, but he didn't hate it, and he had questions about it. He just wanted to kind of get an interpretation. And that, you know, I had a great conversation with the guy, and I thought, that's my kind of reader.
Yes,
you know?
That's what you hope for. Yep. Glad it worked out that way. So you were also on the show not too long ago for our Sacred Cow review of the original Blade Runner, 1982's Blade Runner.
Yep.
And we all agreed that it pretty much held up. I know you had some differences about the Vangelis score, which I don't understand, but I think that was one of your quibbles.
Right, and I don't love some of the high-flown, philosophical hooey with the Rutger Hauer character.
Which I also like.
I know you love that.
So we...
I like it a lot for a lot of other reasons. I've happily revisited the thing over the years now and then.
Good. Well, a note for our radio listeners. In the second half of this show, you're going to get our top five 21st century horror movies. Now, that's a top five, Michael, that you and Adam did together back in 2015, a few years ago now.
Yes.
You're number one. Was Let the Right One In. Does that still sound good to you, sitting here in 2017?
The first Let the Right One In from, yeah. Maybe. God, I got to read. It's funny what 2 years
ago. It goes by fast. Tell me about it. Well, with Halloween approaching, we thought that it would be a good time to revisit that top five. Plus, we do have the current film spotting poll, which is asking about the best horror movie of the last decade. So 2007 to 2017. If you want to be part of that poll, you can visit filmspotting.net. and participate there. Podcast listeners, if you missed that top five and want to catch up with it, you can find it, as well as 12 years of Film Spotting top fives, in the archives over at filmspotting.net. The top five 21st century horror movies that originally aired on episode 532. Before we get to Halloween, though, we must contend with Blade Runner 2049. Early responses to the movie have mostly been rapturous. Time for Michael and I to join in on the praise, or rain, Blade Runner style, on the parade.
There is an order to things. That's what we do here. We keep order. The world is built on a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's no wall, you bought a war.
Blade Runner 2049 had its work cut out for it, Michael. This is not just a sequel some 35 years later to a science fiction property with some convenient name recognition. This is a follow-up to an undisputed classic. The original Blade Runner officially got that designation with our Sacred Cow review a few weeks back. I know you had some reservations, Michael, but they've all been overruled. So classic it is. Let's just start there and move forward.
Good.
Now, as you noted in your Chicago Tribune review of Blade Runner 2049, the 1982 Blade Runner didn't rake it in at the box office, but it did make up for that in cultural cachet. You could argue that the movie was as influential on the sci-fi dystopias that came in its wake as the silent masterpiece Metropolis was influential on it. And so Blade Runner 2049 pulls out some fairly big guns as it tries to live up to the first film's reputation. Director Denis Villeneuve of Sicario and Arrival takes over from Ridley Scott. And he's probably one of the few contemporary filmmakers who can match Scott's sense of visual command. He smartly teams up with the cinematographer Roger Deakins to help him here. In place of original star Harrison Ford, we get Ryan Gosling, like Ford, playing a licensed hunter of renegade replicants, artificially intelligent robots, in a future Los Angeles. The year here, 2049, obviously, rather than 2019 as before. Is Gosling a fair substitute for Ford? We'll get to that, considering Ford reprises his role. His Rick Deckard, who has been in hiding for decades, is tracked down by Gosling's Kay as part of an investigation involving a missing replicant. In that Tribune review of Blade Runner 2049, I mentioned, Michael, you wrote this: a moviegoer can forgive a lot in a movie when the movie offers so much to see. That's as good of a roadmap for our conversation as anything. What needed to be forgiven in Blade Runner 2049, and what should moviegoers be thrilled about getting a chance to see?
Well, let's talk about the second one first, because it really is like it's very much like the first film, I think, Josh, in that whatever, I guess, story and pacing, maybe more rhythm issues the film has that may prevent it from being an enormous popular success, and you know, we can guess about box office and talk about, you know, its financial prospects a lot, but that's less interesting than talking about the movie.
Sure, right.
I think you're right when you say Villeneuve's style, maybe his visual command, you know, is not exactly a replicant of Ridley Scott's, but it's in the ballpark in terms of confidence, really, and sort of an idea about, okay, how are we going to make this world, which is even grimmer than the last one, you know, look, feel, and what's the texture of it, and how is that going to inform the story? I think when you talk about the look of a movie, often you're really sort of saying in code, it's not entirely satisfying on a story level. Mm. And that might be true here, but I don't think you're getting a brand new vision of the future on screen the way you could argue that the first Blade Runner did. I think what you are getting here is an extraordinarily detailed extension of the world created by the first Blade Runner back in 82. It's a lot of the same ideas, consciously evoking the world we got to know through Deckard and his sort of, you know, the odyssey toward finding out, okay, you know, what's my Waterloo? What is the replicant I can't deal with? The first film, you have scenes that echo the first film. In the second, you have Ryan Gosling sitting in the rain outside a noodle shop in this very densely kind of populated, you know, ever raining Los Angeles. You have skies that look more polluted, you know, 30 years more polluted, 35 years really, if you look by the movie's timeline. So 35 years more polluted than before, and you have probably the greatest cinematographer in the you know, alive right now, Roger Deakins, who's been nominated for 13 Oscars and has never won, and he may finally win for this, you know, creating the most ungodly shades of mustard yellow.
Oh, it's amazing, and that sequence.
Yeah, and it's a real paradox, I think. It's like this glamorously ugly vision,
sure,
of the future, you know, and you could say the same about, as you said, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Now, does it add up to a movie that is going to, you know, enter the culture, even if it's a few years later, even if it's after kind of a mild box office disappointment? You know, we'll see. But I think it may have that in common with the first one, though, Josh. I think it's not going to – I don't know if the story, and we'll talk about it, is the kind of thing that's going to get a whole new generation kind of interested in, into this world. What do you think?
Well, it's certainly a different sort of sci-fi story than we normally get, yet wholly in line with what we got in the original Blade Runner. It's moody. It's broody. It takes its time. This is almost 2 hours and 45 minutes. I don't think it needs to be, and that'll probably work against it with audiences. Mm. But at the same time, it's not trying to rev up the original Blade Runner, and I liked that about
right.
it because
right.
I appreciated that sort of, as we discussed in the review, how the original, in our Sacred Cow review, it works as a sci-noir, right? It has a lot of that moodiness and fatalism to it. The images here are dominant. I think they're maybe the film's biggest strength, but I love that because it was also the biggest hurdle given the world that the original Blade Runner and Ridley Scott presented us. I mean, that is one that has been so influential, as I said. And for Blade Runner 2049 to pick up that baton and move it forward even a little bit, like those sequences that take place in Las Vegas, we can say. There's a side trip to Las Vegas. And yeah, it's almost like the entire city has been dumped with Agent Orange that is just hovering in the air. It won't leave. And there's something ghostly and beautiful, as you said, about that, that also marks this thematic idea of increased pollution and the world just going further down the tube. So
right.
I think Blade Runner 2049 nicely splits the middle here in being a worthy successor without pandering to nostalgia, you
right,
could say,
right.
And also without digging too deep into the mythology, which I think some of Scott's other forays into other franchises he's a part of has been a weakness.
I'm going to argue with you.
Okay,
on that
well,
point.
We can
yeah.
we can get into that because what I did find as we will move into the plot here is that the way it touches on what happened before is focused and relatively light, rather than an attempt that might have tried to explain the whole world or expand the world or open up the world here. We'll dance around spoilers as much as we can, but this missing replicant that I referenced is connected to Ford's Deckard. And so that does bring the two characters together. And really what it brought together me more than specific plot points was this idea of artificial intelligent life. Like what is life? When does life come about? And that's something that the original movie was partly concerned with. I think it was more concerned with human mortality and the fact that we have a limited lifespan. And now Blade Runner 2049 moves that a little further by digging into this idea of the replicant experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Warner Brothers is extremely nervous about any plot. In fact, they had people – I didn't sign it, but they had people sign a non-disclosure agreement about what you would not reveal.
And right.
Like right down to like the title of the movie practically. And,
pretty much.
Didn't sign that. So
no,
I
didn't
honestly, and I honestly do believe that, you know, you can talk about certain things in the setup and the premise that happened in the first 20, 25 minutes that are not reveals in any kind of narrative way.
And I think we should, because I think it's important
so
to the film.
You know, Gosling is presumed to be a replicant in this film. And, you know, he's it puts him in a very peculiar hole in the story in that half the world, half this 2049 Los Angeles, you know, the replicants hate him for a lot of reasons, obviously, because he's kind of a turncoat as a
hunter, as a Blade Runner.
And the humans have nothing but disdain for him because he's part of the, quote, slave labor class that is being developed by the company that has taken over from Tyrell Industries. It's now the Wallace Corporation. And this is in the person of Jared Leto as this sight-impaired kind of soothsayer.
CEO.
Genius. He's basically Steve Jobs with even fewer social skills. And it's, you know, he's the Jared Leto character is trying to develop a, let's just say, the newest, highest grade of replicant. And yeah, that's where you get into the issues you talked about, you know, Ridley Scott's preoccupations back in 82, I think. And also, we should say Philip K. Dick from the story he wrote, "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?"
Yeah,
you know how where does the line get extremely blurry between, you know, artificial intelligence and human intelligence? And that's probably enough in terms of the narrative in there. And that's all pretty fruitful, I think.
I think that's too.
A pretty good place to start. I do, you know, and I think Gosling, the casting is actually pretty sharp because in a way I've always found Ryan Gosling. Slightly eerily not quite human, even in romantic comedies, for example. And I think he's a skillful actor and often very effective. And he's also perfect for playing this sort of guessing game about just how, quote, human or how, quote, robotic is he? Because he just doesn't quite, his rhythm is his own.
Yeah, you know, that's a good way to put it.
And yeah, it's different from Harrison Ford, who, in a way, wasn't – in 1982, Harrison Ford was not quite yet an interesting enough actor to kind of get over his own reluctance or, I think, confusion about how to play Deckard. And I do believe that. In this film, Harrison Ford – again, I don't want to talk about how he enters the story or what the plot issues are, but he's doing some of the sharpest, cleanest, subtlest acting of his career. And it almost might not get noticed, Josh, because the look of the film is so overwhelming and all-consuming.
Ford is so good.
He's glad you said that.
He is. And I will agree with you that his performance was probably a weak point of the original Blade Runner. Here, oh man, and the comparison with Gosling is appropriate. I think Gosling works well as that slightly robotic thing he can bring. And I like how the film wittily points out that he is a replicant. Almost the first moment we see him, he's in this flying car that's on autopilot and he seems to be sleeping and there's a noise on the dashboard that would wake him up if he was human, like groggy. But the way Gosling kind of comes to alertness is very machine-like.
Yeah.
And this is before we've really learned anything about him. And right there, the movie is kind of winking like, yeah, he's a replicant.
And I guess like the first film, this is one kind of clear parallel, I'd say. This film, Blade Runner 2049, is sort of this vignette structure odyssey where the Blade Runner, you know, the LAPD cop, in this case Gosling, just has to kind of deal with one piece of the puzzle and another and another. And that's how the first film was structured. And I think it's that structure, Josh, that is because it doesn't really conform to the ordinary action with science sci-fi beats. It's a more methodical take. And, you know, I frankly would have been interested to see – a director, maybe not this particular director, but a director do what Cameron, James Cameron did with the second Alien film, you know, where you had the first, where Ridley Scott's Alien.
I don't know. I mean, like, that was almost my fear, though. Like, you go that full action movie.
Full action movie, yeah.
And maybe it's because there's been so much time between these two films that I'm not ready for a change. Mm-hmm. I'd rather be re-immersed in a world I really appreciated before. You know, if Blade Runner 2049 had come out in 84, 85, maybe I would have been ready, okay, let's take this in a different direction. But there is something exhilarating about being put in that world again in the same sensibility, yet it has a different stamp to it, thanks to Deakins and Villeneuve and, yep. and the other people involved.
Yep.
I want to go back just briefly to Ford, though, because I really don't want to undersell his performance, and I agree with you that it's excellent, and I think there's a point where the two performances by Gosling and Ford go in different directions. They're both given moments of, let's just say, shocking awareness of something.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to take place not at the same time, but in the same room, if you okay, yeah. can recall what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's these intense close-ups on their faces where they're supposed to register, and both of them take at first a fairly subtle approach, and you can just see how it's something that Gosling is playing and something that Ford is feeling, maybe, because this is an incredibly layered, subtle, nuanced performance by Ford, especially in comparison to the original Blade Runner. And I think he sells that moment of awareness for Deckard incredibly well. I also think he brings a little bit of lightness to the movie that it needs. You know, the original as well was very heavy. And I love his early line, which brings us back to the artificial intelligence theme, where he's asked if the dog who's accompanying him is real, right? And this makes sense.
Yeah, real or replicant.
There's not only replicants in this world, but we see a lot of holograms too, right? A lot of people who are holograms but interacting with others in everyday life. So that's a reasonable question. And Ford just growls, I don't know, ask him.
Yeah,
you know? Right. And it's just so great because it's a joke, but it's also, for me, the heart of this movie is considering what's real and what's not. Probably one of the performances we should talk about is given by a hologram named Joy, and the performance is by Ana de Armas. This is Kay's domestic companion, I guess. He goes back to his apartment and turns her on, and then she's projected and she serves him, quote unquote, food. They share, quote unquote, a drink, and they interact this, frankly, like 1950s husband and wife routine. But she becomes more than that as the film progresses, and he has a device that allows him to carry her with her. She almost becomes his partner in the investigation. And the bond between them, you start to feel, is very real. It's almost like in Her, the Spike Jonze film, Her. You get some of that emotional connection there. I love the moment when they're sharing a kiss, again, quote unquote, because she's a hologram, about to share a kiss, he gets a voicemail from his superior that puts her on pause. And he has no choice but to stop in that emotional, supposedly human moment between two not human creatures, whatever you would call them, to respond to work.
Right.
He has no other choice. And there's just something really not only touching about that, but also making us question throughout this movie what is real and what is not, and not necessarily for plot purposes, but for existential purposes.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, as skittish as I am about talking in any more detail about what actually happens in the movie, because that is, I'm afraid, my favorite moment in the film too, because it's appropriately chilly, and it gives you that sort of, you know, that's a question that really echoes throughout the whole movie, and it's best kind of realized in that moment is that, you know, what, you know, we're very close, we're dangerously close to that kind of virtual reality in many parts of our lives anyway.
Yes, we are.
And it's actually not all that, you know, far-fetched to, you know, somehow that seems more attainable in 30 years or 35 years than flying cars, but we'll probably get both, which means that the city of Chicago is going to find a new way to kind of ticket you or tow
yes,
you when it's
exactly.
street cleaning. What, sky cleaning instead of street cleaning?
Meters in the sky, I'm sure, will be something.
But that idea, you know, where the line is blurred to the point where you don't really get clear demarcations of behavior or even intelligence or fear or even sort of, quote, feeling between what is a replicant and what is a human. That's some of what clearly drives Ridley Scott, you know, and as an executive producer on this project, and is all over this version. And that visually, that moment's just really beautifully kind of – the digital effects there are just – you know, simple, small, perfect, great. And they give you the chill that the material, I think, warrants. Now, again, is that enough for an audience to kind of say, oh, I'll see it again? You know, I don't know if it's that kind of film. And, you know, I think that there's also maybe a less helpful kind of Ridley Scott residue to this picture in that the scenes with Jared Leto are so much like the Tyrell Corporation scenes in the first film. That, you know, the audience is kind of out ahead of it, you know, to some degree. And I think that was, you could say the same with some of the, I think you're talking about Alien Covenant and some of the questions about what artificial intelligence and, you know, it's more about God and man and Pygmalion and all those questions about whose fate are being, you know, is controlling what. And these are big questions. It's also, it's a long movie. It's 45 minutes longer than the... A half hour.
It is
at least
almost
a half
2 hours and 45. So
yeah,
it's quite a bit longer.
Half hour at least longer. And is it justified? I'll just say two things, and I'll shut up. There's two peculiarities, I think, in this picture, Josh. As strong as it is visually, I think some of the key action that's kind of more conventionally laid out is some of the least effective stuff in Blade Runner 2049. There's the scene where Gosling and Harrison Ford meet is immediately kind of phased into this sort of brutish fist fight that just sort of goes on forever and basically showing off
in the casino theater.
Don't like that scene.
Oh,
no.
Now that might be my favorite.
No, you're wrong.
go ahead. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Ineffective.
And then I'll try to
I just feel like it's
recover.
It's just sort of, I just feel like it's sort of erratically paced and it's just sort of one idea for 5 minutes practically. And it's just not as effective. And I felt the same way. What about the climax, which, again, without giving anything away, is really just – it's an escape with a lot of water, and it's kind of old-fashioned filmmaking at that point. It's simply a studio water tank and what, you know, what can be done with that kind of more old-fashioned movie technology. But that scene feels kind of a little aimless and just a little off to me. And it surprises me, frankly, that on those two key scenes, things fell down for me a little, but not for you.
Well, no, okay. I'm with you on the scene involving water, the climax.
Okay.
I think that was – you just kept expecting more to happen with it.
Yeah.
And there is some repetition there. So I agree with you there. And maybe I'm more willing to fall in love with the casino theater sequence because I love how it ties into this idea of what's real and what's not. In the background, as part of this now defunct casino, it's performance, which we get a sense used to be hologram icons from earlier eras. So Elvis suddenly will get kicked on. Like it's glitchy. Like all of a sudden we'll have an Elvis performing as if there's a crowd there and then it stops. And in between here, Ford and Gosling are having their physical encounter. And what I like about that is just the echoes of reality and unreality that we're getting because these are, again, potentially two inhuman beings having this deeply human conflict. And at the background, we are getting this inhuman representation of a previous human that's performing for them. And I like that interplay between the two bits.
I like every idea in that scene, but a strong concept. And I just think the
execution
problematic
you, huh?
Execution. I do.
One more for the room.
Had your job once. I was good at it.
I know.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions.
So, Michael, I think I've come across on Facebook pictures, and maybe this was a little while ago, of breakfasts you've made for the family. Is this a habit of yours, making breakfast
for
the family?
We have occasionally put a couple of time-wasting photos and posts on Facebook and featuring myself, my son John, stepdaughter June, you know,
I love it.
Cooking away.
It's inspiring. I'm responsible for breakfast in my house as well. Debbie's usually well out of the door before the rest of us.
To avoid the breakfast.
Well, I hope not. Now I'm double guessing myself.
Does she have a reputation of like showing up to work early?
Husband's making breakfast this morning. So.
Yeah, better. Whoops, I hear a call.
No, my breakfasts are very well received. Michael, and as a matter of fact, encouraged me to try my hand at dinner every once in a while. But really, what's given me the encouragement to do that is Blue Apron. As listeners know, I am a big fan of Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and that's been my experience. I graduated to dinner through Blue Apron because they provide all of the ingredients you need in the box for a great meal, step-by-step instructions, which are crucial for me.
They hold your hand right through it.
They pretty much hold your hand, nice. And I've become a successful dinner cook in addition to being a breakfast cook. And here, this speaks to what we're talking about. The research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. I fully believe that's true, and they also do it together because that's been my experience. And Michael, give folks an idea of what sort of meals I've been cooking. What does Blue Apron offer?
For example, cheesy chicken and black bean enchiladas with salsa verde, shrimp marinara with spaghetti, spinach, and parsley, maple gravy smothered pork chops with stewed collard greens and sweet potatoes, and
the spiced cauliflower and pepper with jasmine rice and cilantro yogurt sauce.
Why, yes, I'd love some.
The one I'm looking for right now are those enchiladas. Sound awfully good. This is all pretty affordable as well. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with those pre-portioned ingredients that I mentioned. There's great variety, as that menu sample shows. You can choose from new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes also are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. And these really are pretty easy to put together. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and you can usually prepare them in about 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/film. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/film. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
They know you're here.
So, Michael, for you, the action maybe is one of those things that needed to be forgiven. For me, I'm with you on Leto, the role. It's creepy, I suppose, as it should be, but the problem is all of his dialogue is thematic. And again, what I appreciate about that forward quip at the beginning is it captures what the movie's about without really stating what the movie is about.
Yeah.
And Leto is constantly stating what the movie is about. I think Robin Wright, who gives a good performance, is also saddled with a few lines like that. We just don't need those because the movie is already doing this thoughtfulness with its visuals. So I think that does hamper things a bit. I will say the production design of those corporate offices, Wallace's offices, is astounding.
Oh, yeah,
this is
great.
Another case of raising the visual bar from the original. There's sort of this honeycomb color is seeping through what are otherwise very sparse, minimalist spaces. It actually reminds me of the interior of the spaceship in Villeneuve's Arrival.
Yes.
So there's a carryover there a little bit. And the lighting in these scenes is exquisite. Unfortunately, what's taking place in there is a lot of that thematic dialogue that I mentioned.
And that's, you have to pin that on the script by Hampton Fancher and Michael Green. I just think it feels 1982, maybe in the wrong way. It doesn't feel like these are, there's not a lot of urgency in the rhythm of the movie. No question about it. And a lot of it's some of that's intentional. We're talking about a world that is where a lot of the life is really kind of leaked out of it, and it's in this bizarre circumstance where uneasy coexistence between humans and replicants, leading to all kinds of little bursts of revolution and outrage and rebellion. Are you hear about that in this film? You don't see it, and I think that those are going to be worlds and avenues explored if there's another film after this. For it, because
oh,
you keep
man.
Hearing about
as much as I like this, I don't want to think about
you
that.
You don't want to know what's going on off world.
I'm partly curious, but I'm just at a point with these franchises where my first response is exhaustion, even in a film that I really enjoyed. And I loved Blade Runner 2049. It's almost like just let me be here for a little bit before I have to worry about all those spinoffs that might come.
Loved it. I liked it.
I really did love it.
Yeah.
And we should also note the production designer here is Dennis Gassner, because we've both cited some examples of beautiful work being done as far as that's concerned. As you're talking about the artificial intelligence and the conflict there, it strikes me that this is maybe more AI, artificial intelligence, Spielberg, than Ex Machina, in that it wants to put us in the experience of the artificially intelligent being. You know, it's more almost emotional in that way, mm-hmm. and trying to align us with them. I think Ex Machina partly did that, but the reason I love that Alex Garland film so much is it also took a very brave step back away from it with its ending. And in a way, it's one of those AI movies that really makes us ask more about humanity than artificial intelligence. And those are the ones that maybe I like more because they resonate more with me. None of us know what purely artificial intelligence is going to be like.
Right.
And so it's somewhat easy to place our emotions on a figure like that.
Yeah.
But this movie very much asks us, what does it mean to be human then? Okay. If mm-hmm. these characters may or may not be human, what does it mean for us to be human based on what we're seeing in them? In Ex Machina, the Alicia Vikander robot essentially made us ask, is empathy crucial to being human? Are you not human until you can express empathy? And here the characteristic that came to mind, and this has to do with the visuals too, is the capability of awe. Once you've expressed awe at something, does that make you human? Because I think that is a recurring motif here. One that's picked up, and maybe you won't appreciate this because I think Rutger Hauer's character in the original is the one who expresses awe.
Right.
And here I think you notice it quite early where there's snow falling in a lot of Blade Runner 2049.
Right.
At first, I thought it was ash, but it does appear to be snow. And a few characters who we understand as replicants express awe at that. The hologram character played by Ana de Armas, in that scene we were discussing, it's raining and she looks up and expresses awe at the rain. And I think this movie does end also with another character expressing awe in the face of something that isn't necessarily technological, but
right.
It's something they're responding to. And so that was just another thread in 2049 that I did appreciate, is this notion that awe might be something we need to make us human.
I think even that's a good point. And I think even I don't want to give too much away on this, on what actually happens, but there's, you know, the most kind of clearly menacing adversary in this picture, played by Sylvia Hoeks, a very good actress.
Yeah, how did that performance
work? Well,
I
liked it a lot. And she plays, you know, kind of Jared Leto's henchwoman and kind of the company's spokesperson who is willing to happily willing to kill for, you know, to protect the secrets, protect the copyright secrets. There's a scene early in the picture. It's a key encounter between that character and the Robin Wright character, and don't want to give it away, but
right.
The way Villeneuve stages that shows what great facility he has, I think, with kind of moments of chilling violence, which is different than a mastery of conventional action. And I think that's where he falls down. It surprises me because the best scene in Sicario, in Villeneuve's Sicario, is that very elaborate shootout at the U.S.-Mexican border. Remember that scene?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's that is really sharp.
Where they're all in the cars and it's like a traffic jam.
Yeah, and that's you can say that's a kind of a conventional setup or just sort of the kind of screen violence we've seen before, but that was done really with a kind of remarkable mastery. And you don't get a comparable scene like that in this picture.
No, and you know what? You're onto something in the speed of an action scene that maybe he is not yet suited for compared to the stillness of the chill you've been mentioning, of a suspense scene. He has that down for sure. And maybe when things need to start moving a little more quickly, that isn't quite as effective.
It's a script problem too.
Could very well be. Blade Runner 2049, it opens in wide release this weekend. So if you see it, let us know what you thought. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, Michael, you are back with me again, taking on a bit of a different film, The Florida Project, director Sean Baker's follow-up to Tangerine. Tangerine won the Film Spotting Golden Brick Award a couple of years back.
Woo-hoo.
Spoiler, can we say this, Michael? Florida Project, very, very good?
Yes, I'd say very, very good.
Okay, so a double appreciation review is coming next
week. A double very, yeah, two verys.
Excellent. Along with that review, we'll have Adam's interview with Sean Baker. If you have any thoughts on this week's show, send us an MP3 or leave us a short voicemail. About 30 seconds is good. We might just use it on next week's show, 312-264-0744. You can find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Jeremy Wellhausen. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. We're always looking to reach new listeners, and that is a great way to do it. Michael, thank you very much for joining me this week. If listeners want to read your Blade Runner 2049 review, they can find that at chicagotribune.com/movies.
You got it.
Okay.
You got it.
On Twitter, where are you?
I'm at Phillips Tribune. Optimistically, I'm keeping that Twitter handle. So.
Good for you. I know it can be rough sometimes out there on Twitter. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.